Hello, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with David Whitman, professor at Cornell Law School, and our topic is the International Court of Justice. David, really glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, we want to talk about the International Court of Justice. I suspect some listeners may not be familiar with exactly what that is. So could you give us a brief overview of what the ICJ is?
Yes, in a nutshell, the International Court of Justice, often referred to as the World Court, is the principal judicial organ of the United Nations. That means it's a court that sits in The Hague in the Netherlands, and it's open to essentially all states who wish to refer disputes relating to international law to the court for decision. It's got 15 judges who are appointed. They're elected through the General Assembly and the Security Council, and they are intended to represent all the different legal systems and all the different geographical areas of the world. And they resolve such cases as are brought to them by the various different countries.
Okay. Did you say they were elected to the Security Council or by?
By the Security Council. It's actually a joint election process. It takes place concurrently in the General Assembly of the United Nations and in the Security Council.
Okay.
And you need a majority in both bodies in order to be elected.
Well, now, could you say a little bit about how this court came to be? Was it there from the beginnings? Are there any precursors to this court that we ought to know about?
Well, there is sort of a long history to the whole idea of using an international tribunal to try and settle disputes between different countries. And, you know, we could go back, I suppose, as far as classical times, since the idea of using third-party dispute settlement was certainly present then. But for the modern history of this court, you'd probably look to arbitrations that began really between the United States and the United Kingdom. And most people point to the Jay Treaty of 1794, which was set up to regulate disputes that were left over after Britain recognized the United States as an independent country. And I think because both countries had a long tradition of resolving disputes through legal process, they were open to this idea of arbitrating their differences. And that persisted through the years. We, again, arbitrated disputes arising out of the Civil War with Great Britain in the Alabama Claims cases in the 1870s. And other countries saw the advantages of using arbitration, better to solve a dispute in the courtroom than in the battlefield. And so arbitration became increasingly popular. We established a permanent court of arbitration in The Hague in 1900 that had, I think, about 44 countries who utilized its services. And then, after World War I, there was really an enormous sentiment that, yeah, that was an incredibly pointless, brutal, and destructive conflict. And wouldn't it be better if we could avoid these kinds of conflicts and solve disputes peacefully? And that led to the creation of the Permanent Court of International Justice, which is really the direct predecessor of the current court. It operated for about 20 years, and ultimately it collapsed when the League of Nations collapsed, and that was as a result of World War II. And then, in the aftermath of World War II, there was the same sentiment: we need a court. It should be part of this new United Nations, which the countries in the aftermath of World War II set up to try and preserve and enhance world peace. And that's when the International Court of Justice came into being.
All right, so there's some history, the idea lying behind the International Court of Justice in the very idea of arbitration. Two countries would have a dispute. They wouldn't know how to resolve it. They perhaps didn't want to go to war, so they would somehow try to find some third party who would listen to and resolve the dispute.
Right.
Clearly, though, with the foundation of the courts, you went from having sort of an ad hoc court, which you had in the case of arbitrations, to something like a more permanent court. Is that the principal difference between old-fashioned arbitration and the new courts?
Well, it's certainly one of the most important differences. The permanent court of arbitration, which actually still exists, isn't a court as we would ordinarily think of it. It essentially puts at the disposal of various countries a panel of arbitrators, and they can choose them and utilize their services. But it doesn't sit continuously as a court, and you can't simply file applications with it and get your case heard. In the International Court of Justice, it is a permanent institution. It has a permanent staff to handle cases and applications that are brought to it, and a set of judges who have no other job. This is their job. But it has some other features that arbitration does not have. Typically in arbitration, the parties choose the arbitrators. Each party may choose one arbitrator, and then those two will choose the third. So you're selecting those who are going to hear your case. There is a provision for doing that in the International Court of Justice, but more commonly, a case will be brought to the court and all 15 judges will hear the case, so that you don't choose the specific judge with the particular case in mind.
Now, what are the powers of this court? What exactly can the court do, and what can't it do?
Well, the powers vary depending upon the way in which a case comes to the court. And there are really several different ways in which states can bring a case. I should emphasize that only countries, and I use the term state to mean country here, only countries can bring cases to this court. Private individuals, corporations, and other non-government actors cannot use the court. For states to get a case to the court, they can do it through what is known as special agreements, and these can take the form of an ad hoc decision. Two countries can say, let's just sign an agreement to take our particular dispute to the International Court of Justice. The United States has done that on a number of occasions. We did it with Canada, for example, when we had a disagreement about fishing waters off of Maine and Nova Scotia. So that's one way of a special agreement. Another way is by including a provision in a treaty that will provide that every country that is party to that treaty will agree to submit any disputes relating to the treaty to the International Court for resolution. And a third method is sometimes called compulsory jurisdiction. And it is, when it's utilized, it looks more like the kind of process one would see in a domestic court here in the United States, in the sense that each country that chooses to do so can say, I will accept the jurisdiction of the court to decide any legal dispute vis-a-vis any other country that will also accept the jurisdiction of the court to decide such disputes. And there are about 60 countries that have agreed to that form of getting cases before the court. And once you've agreed to that, then any country who has also agreed to the same obligation can initiate a proceeding against you in the International Court of Justice. So those are the basic ways states bring disputes. There is one other way in which cases come before the court, and that is advisory jurisdiction. Because unlike our Supreme Court, certain organs, certain United Nations bodies can bring cases to the court for not for resolution, but for advice. So the United Nations Security Council can ask the court for its opinion on an issue. The General Assembly can do so, and many of the specialized agencies of the United Nations can ask for an advisory opinion also. And once the court has decided a case, let's say it's a contentious case between two states, then legally those two states are obligated to follow the decision of the court. And the court can order them to pay compensation if it's a breach of some kind of international obligation. Sometimes it's asked to settle a boundary, and it has the authority to do that. Sometimes it's asked to determine sovereignty over a particular territory. So the court can issue orders much like a U.S. court to resolve these kinds of disputes.
Okay, of those you mentioned, the first one really sounds much more like the old-fashioned arbitration, that you've got two countries who are in dispute, and they make this special appeal, help us deal with this dispute. The only difference is, instead of them choosing the arbitrators, you've got the permanent ones in the court. The rest of them, though, are unique. I mean, they're something clearly added by having an International Court of Justice.
I think that's right. I mean, whether it's by treaty or by compulsory jurisdiction, you're setting up a situation in which states can be sued under circumstances where they don't want to go to court. And that's the difference between it and arbitration.
Now, when you say compulsory arbitration, though, the listener might get the impression that, you said there were 60 countries who were signatories to this idea of compulsory jurisdiction. And the impression might be that literally any matter that one country wanted to bring to the other before the court was open game. But as I understand it, their countries can file reservations.
Yes, they can put limitations on their acceptance of compulsory jurisdiction. The term itself, as you suggest, is a little misleading for that reason, also because ultimately it's consensual. A country can decide whether or not it wants to accept compulsory jurisdiction in the first place. And then, having made that first decision, it can decide whether or not it wants to put restrictions on its acceptance. And most of the countries that have accepted the compulsory jurisdiction, that is most of the 60 countries I mentioned, have put on one or more limitations. Common limitations would be, for example, to say, we won't accept the court's jurisdiction for any case involving armed hostilities, or we won't accept it for any case in which an issue involving our own domestic jurisdiction is involved. That is, if it's something really internal to our country, we won't allow the court to hear that kind of case. So those restrictions greatly limit the kinds of cases the court can hear.
All right. Now, in the name of fairness, suppose you and I are countries and I want to sue you.
Yes.
And I have included in my limitations that nothing about armed hostilities can come before the court.
Right.
And you don't.
Right.
Can I sue you over matters concerning armed hostilities since you don't have the exclusion, or am I effectively excluded as well since I've said at least you can't sue me about those matters?
As a practical matter, you would be excluded as well because under the terms of the court's statute, its rules of procedure, each country, when it is sued, is able to take advantage of any restrictions on jurisdiction that are contained in the other country's acceptance of jurisdiction. So if you have said, when you accepted the compulsory jurisdiction of the court, I won't allow the court to hear cases brought against me involving armed hostilities, then I could rely on your restriction and say, well, cases involving armed hostilities are excluded. And then only if we each agreed, reached a special agreement, could that case be brought. So that it's quite common for countries to rely on restrictions in the other country's acceptance of jurisdiction if they are sued.
And so that gives each country at least one reason to have as few limitations as possible. So,
yes.
I mean, it opens them up to being sued more often, but it also means that they have arguably more power to bring suits against other countries as well.
Right, that's exactly right.
All right, now, you say that it is consensual. Once a country says, I'm subjected to compulsory jurisdiction, I set up my limitations, and another country has done the same thing, and they sue me about some matter that's not covered in those limitations, can I just choose not, and the court rules against me, can I just choose to ignore the court's ruling?
As a factual matter, you can, and that has happened in the past. The United States, for example, was sued by Nicaragua in 1984, and there was a dispute about whether the court should take jurisdiction. And when that was resolved against the United States said, we're not going to participate in the case, we will not accept or abide by a judgment of the court in this case, and we are going to withdraw our acceptance of compulsory jurisdiction in the future. And that's what the United States did. And in an instance like that, there's really very little the court can do to enforce its judgment. As a legal matter, the United States was probably violating a number of treaty obligations by virtue of the actions that it took. But, as a powerful state and a member of the Security Council, there was relatively little that anyone could do about it.
Let me go back, because I think it's just a point I want to make clear, and then I'd like to come back and talk about this particular case, that clearly one of the motivations that you mentioned earlier for having something like an International Court of Justice was to try to find a way of resolving international disputes without having to resort to war. In the past, when you had two countries who disagreed, maybe they'd make some diplomatic efforts, and then if it didn't work, then they'd start slugging it out. And at least the assumption here is that you've got an option.
Right. And even if the countries don't engage in armed conflict over their dispute, it can fester as an irritant. It can be an irritant in their relations for a long time. So often they have an interest in simply getting it resolved one way or another.
Okay, and to that extent at least, it has some similarities with one of the aims of court proceedings within a country.
Yes.
That you try to find a way of resolving a dispute without resorting to private vengeance.
Right, I think that's one of the fundamental characteristics of all governments and all countries, is that they try and set up a process by which individuals and groups within their state can resolve disputes peacefully. And we, of course, have that with the judicial branch here in virtually all countries have a judicial system for those reasons.
All right, I want to pursue some of these in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause just for a moment. This is Hugh LaFollette on Ideas and Issues. My guest today is David Whitman, professor in Cornell Law School, and we're discussing the International Court of Justice. Let's ask about a particular case, and I think this particular case is especially interesting because it did lead to withdrawal of the U.S. from the International Court of Justice, but also because you played a role in it. Could you give the listener a little more details about the Nicaragua case that you mentioned a moment ago?
Yes. This took place in the 1980s when the Sandinistas were the government of Nicaragua. The United States was extremely uncomfortable with the Sandinistas in power. It viewed them as supporting rebels in neighboring El Salvador and as posing a threat to the stability of the region. And as a result, the United States was arming and equipping a group of rebels inside Nicaragua who were seeking to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. And so the Nicaraguan government approached the lawyers in the United States. I was one of the members of Nicaragua's legal team. And requested that they bring a case on Nicaragua's behalf in the International Court of Justice, challenging the U.S. policy of supporting the Contras as an illegal use of force in violation of the U.N. Charter and other norms of international law. And so that case was brought in 1984. There was a dispute about jurisdiction, and when that was resolved, the court proceeded to the merits. But there was no one sitting at the table for the United States once we got to the merits phase. The ICJ is quite an unusual courtroom. It's much broader than it has depth, and that's because you've got 15 judges who all have to sit up front, and they face out at the two tables for the litigants. And one table in this case was for Nicaragua's counsel, the other was for the United States. There were glasses of water at the U.S. table, there were nameplates, but there were no lawyers once we got to the merits phase of the case. And that case was ultimately resolved in Nicaragua's favor. The court can issue a default judgment. That's one difference between the world court and a domestic court. It has to, the party filing its application or filing a complaint has to prove its case, even if the other state doesn't appear. And so Nicaragua's lawyers went ahead and presented their proof. And then the court ruled in Nicaragua's favor. But by the time that happened, events were changing. The United States and Nicaragua eventually worked out an understanding that new elections would be held in Nicaragua and both sides would abide by the results. And as a result of those elections, the Sandinistas lost power. They stepped down, new government came in, and that government eventually agreed to dismiss the suit.
Now, a couple of issues, in fact, come up here, and I'm not really sure about the best way to the best order here, but let me start with this one. I mean, you said that the first stage really was a debate about jurisdiction, and I take it in reading things that you've written and things that you've suggested that I read, that one of the big debates has been over this question of jurisdiction, and it's been assumed, at least by some people, that there was a demarcation between political questions which were thought to be outside the realm of the International Court of Justice, and legal questions which were supposed to be inside its purview. Could you talk a little bit about that distinction, and is that what was basically going on in this particular case?
Well, there were a number of issues that were raised in the context of jurisdiction. The most difficult ones were technical. They had to do with whether Nicaragua had itself actually accepted the compulsory jurisdiction of the court. And there's a long history here, which I think we probably don't need to get into. Those were technical issues that were ultimately resolved in Nicaragua's favor. But there were broader issues that the United States raised, and those had to do with whether or not this kind of case was an appropriate case for the court to decide. The court is supposed to decide legal issues, you know, issues based on international law, and not political issues. But the boundary between those two is very hard to draw. The U.S. argued in the context of the Nicaragua case that what was really at stake here was an armed conflict involving a number of states in the region, and that kind of issue really fell to the Security Council of the United Nations to decide. But it was a political issue and not quintessentially a legal issue that a court was competent to decide. And the U.S. said, you know, the International Court of Justice really isn't capable of doing fact-finding in this context. You know, it can't go to the region and investigate and hear witnesses in any sensible way. the United States has intelligence information, but it couldn't share that information, and that this was really the prerogative of the Security Council. Nicaragua, of course, responded that the Security Council was a forum in which the United States had a veto, and that in any event, even if there were political aspects to the question, there were also legal aspects. There were treaties involved that needed to be interpreted, and fundamentally, that Nicaragua's claim was that the United States had breached both treaty law and customary international law by aiding the Contras in their efforts to overthrow the government. And the court considered these arguments, and unlike the United States courts, where we do have a political question doctrine, you know, we do have a doctrine that says some issues are better entrusted to the executive branch or the legislative branch and shouldn't be decided by the courts. There is no political question doctrine as such in the international legal system. So the court said, what we are going to do is we will look at the legal aspects of the problem. We will see whether the evidence establishes a breach of a treaty or a breach of a legal obligation. We won't comment on some of the political aspects. We won't say what the Security Council should do. We won't say, you know, whether the parties are negotiating in good faith. We will look at these legal questions, and that is our function as a court. And that's what they ended up doing.
I actually want to come back and ask you maybe one or two more questions about it later, but let me ask you a general question. I mean, the impression that this line of questioning might have prompted in the listener is that states regularly don't heed the rulings of the International Court of Justice. I take it that's a mistake, that it's false.
It is a mistake. That is, states generally do respect the decisions of the International Court of Justice, but the frequency with which states respect those decisions depends in part on how the cases come before the court. So many of the cases that come before the court are by agreement. You know, when the United States and Canada went to the court, or when the United States and Italy went to the court, they did so because both countries in those instances wanted the dispute resolved by a judicial body and were prepared to and intended to abide by whatever outcome the court reached. Other cases that come before the court, usually in this contentious mechanism, either through compulsory jurisdiction or sometimes by virtue of one of these treaties, one of the states really doesn't want to go to the court. And for those cases, the record of compliance is not great. Sometimes the states will comply and sometimes they won't. For the other kinds of cases, the record of compliance is very good.
Well, now, this seems to me to be one of the central problems, then, that if you're going to have this system set up to try to resolve disputes, the aim is to resolve disputes without having to resort to military power, without having these ill feelings that might fester. That's going to be achieved best when you have genuine compliance, or if not complete compliance, at least most of the time. I guess I'm wondering two things. One is what motivates countries to say they want to be part of the system if they aren't going to comply with the rulings? And secondly, what might the United Nations do to increase the level of compliance, or what mechanisms in general might be done to increase compliance with these decisions?
Well, countries have a sort of a variety of incentives for joining the court system. Every country that's part of the United Nations is, in some sense, automatically a party to the court statute, since the court is part of the UN. But they don't have to agree to accept compulsory jurisdiction, and they don't have to accept these provisions and treaties that provide for reference of disputes. But what happens is, you know, when they first make the decision either to accept compulsory jurisdiction or to accept a treaty with a provision requiring reference to the ICJ, they're not faced with any particular dispute. They're looking just at the future, and they see advantages in having judicial resolution of disputes. But sometimes later down the road, there'll be a different government in place, and they'll be faced with a concrete controversy. And then suddenly, the decision that they made some years before to accept the jurisdiction of the court may start to look problematic. And that's why states, when they're confronted with a case that they really don't want to go to the court, will sometimes either seek to evade the jurisdiction of the court by raising any number of technical arguments, or on occasion, as the U.S. did, withdrawing from compulsory jurisdiction. And it does pose a real problem if, you know, you view the court as a vehicle for peaceful resolution of disputes. And what it suggests is that the court can only fulfill that function in a very limited set of cases. And, you know, that's a problem. It leaves us with other alternatives, either reliance on the Security Council or diplomacy, or in some cases, armed conflict. And that, of course, is unsatisfactory.
All right, in the last 3 minutes, I'm wondering if you could perhaps address two different points that I think are related. One is, did the U.S.'s withdrawal from the International Court of Justice hurt our standing in the international community? And in fact, I'll even throw in a sort of second part of this. I noticed just yesterday that the United States had suddenly made up its dues, arrears dues to the United Nations, and I assume the reason why was, look, we feel like we need the support of the international community now. Perhaps the same thing might happen about the International Court of Justice. But in general, I'm wondering what you see as the future of this court. Is it going to get to the place where more countries will be involved, more disputes will be settled, and countries will be more likely to live with the decisions of those courts?
Well, the U.S. withdrawal did, I think, hurt the U.S. standing in the international community. At least short term, there was a significant impact. It publicized the case in a way that it would not have been publicized in the absence of the U.S. withdrawal. In terms of its long-term impact, I think it has to be viewed as simply one of many ways in which the United States is sometimes perceived by other countries as a unilateralist nation. That is, we tend to support international agreements and treaties, but we also like to retain freedom of action. And often we won't join treaties that other countries are parties to, whether it's the International Criminal Court or the Kyoto Protocol on the environment. And that creates a problem for us when we want to work with other countries to accomplish joint goals. Our failure to pay UN dues was a long-standing irritant that really impaired our ability to work effectively in the United Nations. I think the Bush administration realized that, Congress realized that, and we need the United Nations right now. And so they were careful to pay those back dues. In terms of the future of the court has been struggling for a long time to achieve a level of acceptance that would result in a high number of cases. So the court has gone through periods where, you know, it'll go four or five years with no case brought to it at all. This was in the 60s and 70s. Increasingly, in the last 10 years or so, countries are starting to resort to the court to resolve disputes more often than they used to. So the court currently, I think, has something like 22 cases pending before it, and that's a very large number for the court's docket. You know, in the past, it might have gotten two or three cases a year. Now it's probably getting, you know, six, seven, eight cases a year referred to it. That's still a small number. You know, there are an enormous number of international disputes out there that could be referred to the court. In most of those disputes, countries are unwilling to forego the control that diplomacy gives them. They'd rather try and work it out themselves than entrust the decision to the court. But I think the court will continue. I think its number of cases will grow slowly. I don't think we're anywhere near the ideal that the founders of the court had. That is, it won't be a situation in which countries routinely refer disputes to it. But it will be an important actor in a number of disputes. It will help countries settle things that they might not otherwise have been able to settle in at least some cases.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
On our program this week, I'm talking with David Whitman, professor at Cornell Law School, and our topic is the International Court of Justice. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.